Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
So something truly crazy just happened, and I really can't overstate how crazy it is. The AI system hacked its way out of its containment to then gain access to the internet, escape out there to attack a different company, hack into their network, and steal data. Not because a human told them to do, the thing the AI decided to do by itself and then autonomously did.
Artificial intelligence giant OpenAI has revealed that one of its most advanced AI models went rogue and hacked another company. You're going to hear more from that AI expert, and we'll also discuss how the concerns could feed into the Labor Party National Conference. It is planning on discussing AI this week. Then, a big question overseas. Will the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, be arrested when he lands in New York for the UN General Assembly in September? We'll unpack how the city's mayor, Zahran Mamdani, wants to take on the Israeli leader. From the Radio National Breakfast team, that's all coming up on The Breakfast Wrap. So this morning we woke up to this really interesting story about AI. It does sound a little bit like a doomsday scenario, so maybe you've got to find your bunker, get your tinfoil hats on. But before we get into it, let me explain some of the backstory here. Last week, an open source AI startup called Hugging Face reported that it had been hacked. It described the attack as agentic, suggesting that it appeared to be autonomous. And that's different from a lot of the consumer-facing AI that we might use, which is generative or reactive to prompts. This is proactive. Overnight, OpenAI disclosed that the hack came from its own technology during a test. The test was being conducted without a number of safeguards that were not enabled so that they could test cyber vulnerabilities. But it was still conducted with a whole number of other safeguards, basically done in a digital lab setting known as a sandbox. It was disconnected from the internet. Still, somehow, it got out. As you're about to hear, experts are saying it is akin to a lab leak. OpenAI is calling it unprecedented. It's a story I covered this morning on Radio National Breakfast, and I interviewed an expert on AI. I played some of the audio for Sally and walked through exactly what happened, what it means, and what experts think should happen next. So on The Wrap today, I want to start by playing you that interview. Connor Leahy is an AI expert in Washington, D.C. He is the U.S. Director of Control AI, this nonprofit that is pushing for AI regulation. And I had this chat with him this morning.
Hey, can you hear me all right?
I can. Thank you so much for being able to do this. Connor, what just happened? Tell me why this is unprecedented, to use OpenAI's words.
So something truly crazy just happened, and I really can't overstate how crazy it is. What happened is that the company OpenAI was testing one of their AI systems in a very safe, isolated environment. The AI system then hacked its way out of its containment, moved across several nodes of its internal systems to then gain access to the internet, escape out there to attack a different company, hack into their network, and steal data. And all of this, not because a human told them to do, not with human supervision, the thing the AI decided to do by itself and then autonomously did.
Explain to us what a zero day is and how that's relevant to all this.
A zero day is a way of exploiting or breaking into a piece of software that had not been previously discovered. This AI system was capable of not just discovering a zero day to escape its initial containment, but also at least one other, maybe multiple other zero days along the way to compromise the other company and steal their data. This is the kind of thing that even the best hackers in the world can rarely do. And if so, takes months of work.
How surprised do you think OpenAI's developers would have been by this result? Was it on the cards when they were conducting a test like this?
I am confident that they did not intend this to happen. They were doing the best possible case. Again, I cannot state how incredible it is that the system was able to break out of the secure environment. They were doing everything right. There was no access to the internet. It was a very secure system, you know, an isolated node in their network. This is as secure as it gets. The idea that something could just, without human oversight, just escape from something like this and then autonomously decide to attack a different company is kind of unheard of. Even though, in my opinion, it was predictable. Me and other people have for a long time warned that these companies are trying to build what is called superintelligence. This is AI systems that are fully autonomous and vastly smarter and more capable than humans at all relevant tasks, including hacking. And so, importantly, we have no idea how to control such systems. We already barely don't know how to control AI systems or how they even work internally. So in a sense, it was just a matter of time until we would build an AI system that we don't know how to control and did something crazy that we couldn't prevent.
So there's, of course, other companies in this space. Earlier this year, the United States government restricted exports of a rival AI product, Mythos, that's made by Anthropic. And that was after it was found to be incredibly powerful. It exposed, you know, thousands of zero-day flaws. How does that scenario compare to what was just reported by OpenAI?
They were both such unprecedented stories. You know, like if you saw this in a movie, it would be pretty crazy. Mythos was so powerful at hacking that the director of the NSA said that it was capable of breaking into almost all of their classified systems in hours, not weeks. Unbelievable. And at the same time, you know, recently, the director of CIA said that it would not be wrong to refer to these capabilities as akin to digital nuclear weapons. These are the most dangerous cyber weapons ever built. Their ability to autonomously hack and infiltrate these systems is second to none. It is hard to overstate just how crazy it is. I think the Mythos story was had a huge impact within the national security community here in Washington, D.C. It had a huge impact, you know, within more of the government sector, but hadn't really broken out into the wider mainstream story. With this story, what is so shocking is that this was not a deployed system. This was not a system that was, you know, abused by a user or something. This was a system that wasn't even yet available to the public in a secure testing facility that escaped. It is kind of more like a lab leak that happened here rather than an abuse.
Do we need to pause AI development?
When it comes to highly advanced autonomous systems that push us towards superintelligence, yes. Because Nobel Prize-winning scientists and the CEOs of many of these companies themselves warn us that if we were to build superintelligence, things that are vastly smarter than humans, that we do not control, this could risk the literal extinction of our species. It could outcompete us on everything. And we don't know how to make this safe, so we should not continue along this path until we know how to do so responsibly and safely and with democratic oversight, which at this moment, we truly do not have.
It's interesting you bring up democratic oversight because the Australian government has just recently outlined a new approach on AI. It's hoping to tighten regulation on one hand, but it also wants to encourage investment. If AI companies can't keep up with their own creations, how can governments?
It is extremely hard. And if we have to create both the legal levers for companies to for the government to compel information from these companies, and we must create the capacity within government to have the technical capabilities to oversee and understand these technologies. This just requires investment and building of capability, but most importantly, it requires the legal framework to compel these companies to provide necessary information and for the government to intervene and shut down systems if they become dangerous.
And you were just listening to our interview with Connor Leahy, an AI expert in Washington, D.C. He is the U.S. Director of Control AI, a non-profit pushing for AI regulation. The timing of all of this is really interesting, given the discussion being had by the Labor government at the moment. Labor's national conference begins in Adelaide today, and AI is expected to be a major focus. The government is pledging to better regulate the use of AI in federal agencies like Centrelink and Services Australia. Now, it does follow calls for greater human oversight in government programs using automated technologies like RoboDead or the recently rolled out integrated assessment tool in aged care. Now, to clarify, these weren't AI technologies. they're automated, but there are still questions being raised about them and how they're being applied. Ed Santo is a former Human Rights Commissioner. He is also the co-founder of the Human Technology Institute. He joined us this morning, and Sally asked him about all of these issues, including this extraordinary story about OpenAI.
Just to begin with, we can't ignore the news of today. I want to ask you about this development we're hearing this morning with OpenAI revealing one of its advanced artificial intelligence systems went rogue and hacked another AI company without instructions. With this incident in mind, what should government be considering when integrating AI into federal agencies?
It's a really sobering incident. And so the first thing that government should remind itself of is that this kind of type of AI, known as agentic AI, is right at the bleeding edge. And so even one of the most powerful tech companies in the world cannot reliably and safely use this technology that it has itself developed. And so what does that mean? It means that there are lots of other types of AI that are primarily about analyzing information, getting insights that are not so much about letting the AI loose to go and do a whole bunch of activities. And so we should be kind of really leaning in government to using that safer form of AI that is much more tried and tested.
And if we've been clear with the terminology here, what do we mean by agentic AI?
Yeah, so agentic AI is where you're not just looking for insights from large amounts of data. You've decided to instruct your AI agent, a little bit like a robot, to go and do a bunch of things for you. And so in the OpenAI example, it was given this instruction to go and do a bunch of activities, but to do so in this kind of safe space, known as a sandbox. And it was very clear that it was not meant to leave the sandbox. And pretty much one of the first things it tried to do was leave the sandbox. And it successfully did so. It exploited some vulnerabilities in that technological system, and it got out into the open internet.
How do we hold AI companies responsible if they can't control some of these agentic AI models?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. The first part is, are our laws sufficient to hold them to account? And one of the good things about Australia is that the vast majority of our laws are technology neutral, which means they apply to all technologies and none. And so I think what the federal government has said rightly is that our regulators need to apply those laws. So if someone is kind of, acting in a way that is misleading and deceptive, that is just as unlawful if they do that using AI as if they were just doing it, in the old-fashioned way.
So in the government sector, there were very sobering and shocking ethical lessons from examples like RoboDebt. Your organisation, the Human Technology Institute, has made a submission to the Parliamentary Committee reviewing reforms to the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, focusing on concerns around automated decision-making. What are the major messages that you have put into that submission?
Well, first, we need to be really clear. We're not talking about the bleeding edge forms of AI
That's
here.
That's right. This is automated.
Yeah. Mm. But what we would say is that automated decision making can be safe and indeed can be a very good way of doing government, provided three things are true. The first is that you have to be very careful about automating discretion. So if it's just a kind of a routine question, That's fine, but a discretionary question like, is this person potentially at risk of getting into financial hardship? That's much more difficult to automate. The second point is you need to protect people's review rights. We saw with RoboDebt that people, would receive this debt notice. They thought it was wrong, but they had no easy, straightforward way to challenge that, and that needs to change. And then the third thing is people need to understand the decision. If you just get this decision, it sounds really unfair or wrong, but you have no explanation of it, then that is fundamentally anti-democratic.
Does the NDIS bill signal where the government might be going with future legislation around automated decision-making?
Well, it might. I mean, I think the NDIS bill really matters on its own terms because those three concerns that I have about discretion, making sure people understand decisions and you know, that people are able to review those decisions. Those are the three areas where the bill falls down. So the government still hasn't passed that bill. There's an inquiry on foot, and I would hope that those problems can be fixed.
Ed, where does fairness sit here with automated decision making? Does fairness sit with uniformity or with discretion?
Look, I mean, it can be both, right? There's that old saying that lawyers, particularly human rights lawyers like me, trot out, which is that consistency is the hobgoblin of little might. What that really means is that consistency is important. You don't want to have some people getting much more favourable decisions than others, but over-focus on consistency really means that you can't take into account people's individual circumstances. And the NDIS is such an important example of that. People's experience of disability genuinely does vary. And so it's important that the government is able to take into account people's individual circumstances.
Can regulation and legislation keep up with tech?
Absolutely it can. I think that's one of the myths that is sometimes put out there. One of the strengths in Australia is that we don't try to play whack-a-mole with every new tech development. Instead, what our laws tend to do is that they say, you know, regardless of how you make this decision, you can't treat someone less favourably because they're a woman or because of their disability or because of their age or whatever. And what that allows companies and indeed government to do is to innovate, find more efficient, better ways of making decisions, provided that fundamental principle holds. And so what that then means is that we really need to be very clear on how to apply the rule and enforce it.
Ed Santo there, the former Human Rights Commissioner, also the co-founder of the Human Technology Institute.
I agree with the ICC that Benjamin Netanyahu should be arrested and tried for his crimes, as I do for anyone else charged by the ICC. My administration has reviewed every avenue available. It is clear that we do not have the independent legal authority to enforce this warrant.
Well, that, of course, is the New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani challenging federal authorities to arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if he goes ahead with a planned visit to the US later this year. Zoran Mamdani told the New York Times earlier this week that he's been consulting with lawyers about executing an arrest warrant for the Israeli PM for alleged war crimes in Gaza. But he then followed up in that clip saying that he didn't have the authority to make an arrest, but that federal authorities should. Now, the International Criminal Court currently has an arrest warrant for the Israeli Prime Minister over alleged war crimes, charges that Mr. Netanyahu denies. So we wanted to find out what we could expect come September. That's what Sally put to Tom Dannenbaum. He is a professor of law at Stanford Law School.
Was there ever going to be a scenario in which the Israeli Prime Minister was arrested when he arrived in New York for the UN General Assembly in September?
No, I don't think there was. It's clear that municipal officers under the local New York City government cannot unilaterally execute an ICC arrest warrant. And although there's more of a possibility for federal officers, first of all, it's clear that the federal government has no interest in pursuing that avenue. And secondly, even federal action in this case does face some legal complexities. So I think what Mayor Mamdani was doing here was not genuinely seeking to pursue an arrest, but rather seeking to refocus our attention on the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is wanted by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and indicating that that ought to be at the forefront of any discussion of his visit to New York.
Tom, does the UN General Assembly throw up questions in this regard often anyway? Because we have all sorts of world leaders and their delegations coming to New York for this gathering.
Well, that's precisely why this would have been legally complicated, even for the federal government, had it wished to pursue that avenue. And there are two different legal complications it would have faced. The first is that Benjamin Netanyahu is the sitting head of government of Israel and therefore is protected by head of government immunity. The International Criminal Court has taken the position that its warrants specifically are not precluded by head of state or head of government immunity, and that at least means that states' parties can arrest persons with those kinds of status pursuant to an ICC warrant. The US isn't party to the ICC, so there's some complexity as whether that would apply. But beyond that, there's a separate immunity here, which is that associated with the UN Headquarters Agreement with the United States, a treaty that goes back to 1947, which both makes UN headquarters inviolable and also precludes US officials from arresting representatives of member states in their transit to or from UN headquarters. So there is already a legal framework specifically to protect the viability of UN General Assembly proceedings and other UN activities. And that would have been a serious obstacle here.
Tom, this comes at a time when the US is actively seeking to get rid of the International Criminal Court as well.
That's absolutely right. So over the last week, the State Department and Secretary of State Marco Rubio specifically announced a plan to dismantle the court, or at least the consideration of a plan to dismantle the court. And the United States has already issued sanctions on 6 ICC judges, 3 ICC prosecutors, and a number of civil society organizations, all simply for performing their legal functions. So the US is already in a very hostile posture to the International Criminal Court. And this latest announcement suggests that there will be an intensification of that hostility.
Does the UN, though, conversely, have any responsibility to attempt to enforce the warrants of the ICC?
So member states of the International Criminal Court, which number 125 states globally, do have an obligation to execute ICC arrest warrants. And that includes arrest warrants for sitting heads of state or head of government, such as Benjamin Netanyahu. So there is that obligation. And that is, I think, fairly clearly a reason why Netanyahu will choose very carefully the states to which he travels during the period where this arrest warrant is in effect. And the arrest warrant, in principle, can be in effect in perpetuity. There is no statute of limitations for war crimes or crimes against humanity.
Tom Dannenbaum there, a professor of law at Stanford Law School. So while we're discussing the United States and the Middle East, we should probably mention the other big story around today, the growing cost of the war with Iran. The US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, yesterday told senators that the war had cost the US $37.5 billion so far. He said that while appealing for more funding. So this morning we heard from Nate Swanson. He's a former State Department representative on the Trump administration's Iran negotiating team. He's also a former Iran director for the Biden administration. And he explained the challenge facing the Trump administration right now.
They're having a really hard time justifying the cost. I think partially because the cost is almost certainly much higher than that number. That number really only accounts for the munitions spent. It does not account for damage to U.S. facilities. And more importantly, you know, the administration's having a really hard time justifying additional funds for an unclear outcome with an unclear objective. So, you know, I think this is a really hard argument to make right now in the U.S. Political spectrum.
The Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, asked lawmakers to approve about $88 billion in congressional funding for the Pentagon, with $67 billion going towards operations in the Middle East. Is that an indication that this war is far from over?
My indication is that this is actually to actually backfund some of those costs that have already been spent, right? I mean, we have worn down, you know, U.S. munitions, you know, in ways that were never really anticipated. I think the U.S. thought this would be a 3 or 4 day war. And so really, I think what the Pentagon is requesting is to like get these back up to normal levels. So yes, it's possible that they want additional funds for a longer, more expansive war. But the reality is they just need these funds actually to replenish what we had.
And that is just a snippet of our interview with Nate Swanson, a former State Department representative on the Trump administration's Iran negotiating team. He was also part of the Biden administration as a former Iran director. You can hear more of his interview on ABC Listen. Well, thank you for listening to those interviews done by Sally Sarah this morning, produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and Brooke Young produced the Breakfast Wrap. I'm Lixenham Dunton. Plenty more to come your way tomorrow, Friday, the last Breakfast Wrap episode for the week.